A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
There's a man in his bathroom at 7 in the morning, phone in one hand, tape measure in the other, trying to photograph his own abdomen in the mirror without looking like he's composing a dating profile for his navel.
The angle on that's difficult. You need the phone low enough to catch the profile, but high enough that the flash doesn't wash out the contour.
Daniel's been at this for years, and he's decided the only way forward is to become his own dataset. He's years out from abdominal surgery. He gets visible distension after eating. And he started taking photos. Flat stomach in the morning versus whatever a cheese sandwich and water does to him by mid-morning. He wants to know whether the tape measure method is actually useful. What normal post-meal expansion looks like as a percentage. And how to take photographs that a neurogastroenterologist could actually use.
And the answer to all three is yes, sort of, and it depends on how much you enjoy standing against a wall with masking tape on the floor.
I knew there'd be a neurological twist in here somewhere. You've been waiting to talk about abdominophrenic dyssynergia again.
I haven't been waiting. I've been quietly accumulating.
So what's really going on with this kind of bloating? Because Daniel's describing something that looks like a gas problem, but probably isn't.
That's the core of it. The visible distension, the pregnant paunch he's describing, that's not necessarily gas pushing the abdominal wall outward. In a lot of these post-surgical cases, and in a lot of functional GI disorders generally, the distension comes from a muscular coordination problem. The diaphragm and the abdominal wall muscles are supposed to work together during breathing, and when they don't, the abdominal contents get pushed forward and down instead of being held in place. That's abdominophrenic dyssynergia.
Which is a phrase that sounds like it was designed to make patients nod, and then immediately forget what their doctor said.
It's a terrible name, but the mechanism is specific. Normally, when you inhale, the diaphragm descends and the abdominal wall relaxes slightly to accommodate the viscera. In abdominophrenic dyssynergia, the diaphragm descends, but the abdominal wall muscles contract instead of relaxing. So the pressure has nowhere to go except outward. The belly protrudes. And the amount of gas in the gut is completely normal.
So the distension is a posture problem, not a gas problem.
A breathing coordination problem. And it's often missed because gastroenterologists are trained to think about gas, motility, fermentation, bacterial overgrowth. They're not necessarily thinking about the diaphragm as a culprit. The diagnosis usually comes from a pulmonary function test or ultrasound showing that the abdominal wall is contracting when it should be relaxing.
And this is the part where I ask why this matters for Daniel's tape measure.
Because, if his distension is abdominophrenic dyssynergia, the tape measure is actually a pretty good outcome instrument. There was a biofeedback trial a few years back, 2019, where they took patients with confirmed abdominophrenic dyssynergia and used waist girth as one of the outcome measures. The patients did biofeedback to retrain the abdominal wall and diaphragm coordination, and their girth measurements dropped significantly after treatment.
How significantly?
I don't have the exact centimeters in front of me, but the point is the tape measure captured the change, which means Daniel's instinct is right. The measurement isn't just for show. It can track whether a treatment is working if he gets to a treatment.
But here's the thing he asked that I suspect has no answer. What's the normal range for post-meal expansion? Give me a percentage.
There isn't one. And I want to be clear about this because it's the most important thing he asked. Healthy volunteers in meal studies show girth increases on the order of 2 to 5 centimeters after eating. That's the rough range. But it's not standardized. Different studies use different measuring points, different meals, different timing. Nobody has published a clean, normal percentage threshold for waist expansion after a meal. The Rome Foundation guidelines for functional GI disorders emphasize patient-reported bloating and distension, but they don't give you a number to aim for.
So Daniel's asking for a benchmark that the field hasn't built yet.
And that's not a failure of his question. It's a gap in clinical practice. He's essentially trying to create his own baseline because nobody else has one for him.
That's a very specific kind of frustration. You want to know if your number is normal, and the honest answer is, we don't know what normal is, but here's a range from a handful of studies that weren't designed to answer your question.
Right. And the 2 to 5 centimeters is confounded by everything. Time of day matters, posture matters, whether you've had a bowel movement matters, what you ate matters. A high-fat meal is going to slow gastric emptying and keep the stomach distended longer. A high-fiber meal adds bulk. A carbonated drink adds gas that actually is gas for once.
So the tape measure is useful for trends, not for comparing yourself to a population.
That's the honest framing. If Daniel measures at the navel every morning before eating, and then measures again at a fixed time after a standardized meal, say 2 hours after the cheese sandwich, he can track whether his numbers are stable, improving, worsening. What he can't do is say, my 4 centimeter increase is abnormal because normal is 2.5.
But he can say, my 4 centimeter increase is consistent across 30 days, and that's a pattern.
And patterns are what a neurogastroenterologist can work with. Especially if the photos line up with the measurements.
Let's talk about the photos, because that's the part where I think Daniel might actually be doing something more useful than he realizes.
He's doing what a lot of patients do instinctively. They photograph the thing that bothers them because they know the doctor won't see it in the office. The problem is, most of those photos are useless. Bad lighting, inconsistent distance, the phone tilted at an angle that flatters or exaggerates depending on the day.
So what makes a good clinical photo of a bloated abdomen?
Consistency, mostly. Same distance from the camera every time, same angle, same lighting, same background. You want a front view and a side view. The side view is actually the more informative one for distension, because you can see the contour of the abdominal wall relative to the chest. If the belly protrudes past the rib cage, that's visible in profile. If it's just a little puffiness, the front view might not capture it.
So Daniel should be standing against a wall like he's getting a mugshot for his stomach.
Unironically, yes. You can adapt the clinical photography guidelines from dermatology, which is the field that's actually standardized this. Fixed distance, consistent angle, even lighting with no harsh shadows, neutral background. For abdominal distension, you want the camera at navel height, not chest height, because shooting downward foreshortens the abdomen and hides the contour.
And he should mark the floor with tape, so he's standing in the same spot every time.
That's the kind of thing that sounds obsessive, but makes the difference between data and a photo album. If he uses the same spot, same distance, same camera height, then the photos are comparable across weeks. If he doesn't, the photos are just a record of how he felt that day, which has some emotional value, but almost no clinical value.
And he should take them at the same time of day, presumably. Morning flat, post-meal bloated.
Morning fasting is the baseline. Then post-meal at a fixed interval. If the meal is the cheese sandwich and water, then it's always the cheese sandwich and water. Same meal, same timing, same measuring point. Otherwise, the variables multiply and the data gets noisy.
There's something almost touching about the idea of a man eating the same cheese sandwich every day for a month, just to establish a baseline.
It's the scientific method applied to lunch. And honestly, for a patient who's been dismissed by doctors for years, it's a form of self-advocacy. He's building the evidence that his body is doing something specific and reproducible.
Let's get into the mechanisms a bit more, because I think there's a distinction Daniel's photos might help clarify. He said the distension makes him look like a pregnant man. That's a specific shape.
The shape matters. Abdominophrenic dysenergia tends to produce a lower abdominal protrusion that worsens through the day because the muscle coordination problem gets worse with repeated breathing cycles and with the abdominal contents pressing down. Gastroparesis, on the other hand, tends to produce early satiety, nausea, and less dramatic visible distension because the food is sitting in the stomach, but the abdominal wall isn't being pushed out by the same mechanism. SIBO can produce bloating that's more diffuse and associated with gas and belching.
So the pattern of when the distension appears and where it sits could point to one mechanism over another.
That's exactly what a neurogastroenterologist would look at. Timing, triggers, severity, associated symptoms. Photos plus tape measurements plus a symptom log. That's the bloating diary. And the diary is what differentiates the causes.
And the diary is also what Daniel can hand to a doctor who might otherwise spend 20 minutes trying to understand what he means by bloated.
Which is the other problem. Bloating is subjective. Distension is objective, but patients often use the words interchangeably, and doctors don't always distinguish. If Daniel can show a photo of his abdomen flat in the morning and distended after a cheese sandwich, that's not subjective anymore. That's a measurement.
Even if the measurement is just a photo and a tape number that has no population benchmark.
The benchmark problem is real, but it's also not as fatal as it sounds. A neurogastroenterologist doesn't need to know the population normal to look at a series of photos and say, that's abdominophrenic dyssynergia, or that's not. The pattern is diagnostic even without a normal range.
So the tape measure is for tracking change over time, and the photos are for pattern recognition.
And the symptom log is for correlation. If the distension always follows fatty meals, that points toward bile acid issues or motility problems. If it follows any meal regardless of composition, that points toward the muscular coordination problem. If it's worse with carbonated drinks, that's gas, actual gas for once.
Daniel's 7 years out from gallbladder surgery. That's relevant here, because the surgery itself can disrupt the normal accommodation reflex.
Right. The stomach is supposed to relax to hold food. That's gastric accommodation. After abdominal surgery, adhesions or nerve damage can disrupt that reflex. The stomach doesn't relax as well, so the food sits there and the pressure builds. And if the abdominal wall is also not coordinating properly with the diaphragm, you get the visible protrusion.
So the surgery might have set up the conditions, and the abdominophrenic dyssynergia might be the thing that makes it visible.
That's a plausible mechanism. And it's why the biofeedback angle is interesting. If the problem is partly muscular, then retraining the muscles could reduce the distension, even if the underlying gut issues remain.
But biofeedback isn't something Daniel can do at home with a tape measure.
No, it's a clinical intervention, but the tape measure is how he'd know if it worked. And the photos are how he'd convince a doctor to try it in the first place.
Let's talk about the practical limitations of the tape measure, because I think Daniel's question was deceptively simple. Is it as simple as running a tape around the belly button?
It's that simple, and also not. The navel is the right landmark because it's consistent and easy to find. But the measurement is confounded by everything. Posture, time of day, hydration, bowel contents, whether he's holding his breath or relaxing. If he measures in the morning after urinating and before eating, that's one thing. If he measures after a glass of water and a cheese sandwich, that's another. The tape measure doesn't know the difference.
So, the protocol has to be rigid.
Same time, same position, same point on the abdomen, same tension on the tape. You want the tape snug but not compressing. You want to measure at the end of a normal exhale, not holding your breath. And you want to record the number immediately, because memory is useless for this.
And he should probably measure more than once, to account for the fact that he's a human being who shifts slightly between measurements.
Three measurements, take the average. It's what we did in the clinic for anything that mattered. It's not overkill, it's just basic measurement hygiene.
You practiced medicine in Jerusalem for years. Did you ever have patients bring in their own photos or measurements?
Occasionally, and the ones who did it well were rare. Most people brought in a single photo taken from a weird angle with bad lighting, and I'd have to squint and pretend it was informative. The patients who brought in a series, same position, same lighting, those were the ones I could actually use.
So Daniel's instinct to create a series is the right one.
It's the difference between a snapshot and a data set. A snapshot tells you how someone felt in that moment. A data set tells you whether the thing is stable, worsening, responding to something.
And the percentage question. I keep coming back to that. He wants to know what normal expansion looks like as a percentage of initial waist circumference, and the answer is nobody knows.
The honest answer is that the studies that have measured this in healthy people used absolute centimeters, not percentages. 2 to 5 centimeters is the rough range, but the percentage depends on the starting circumference. For someone with a 90-centimeter waist, 2 to 5 centimeters is about 2 to 5.5%. For someone with a 70-centimeter waist, it's 3 to 7%. The percentage framing doesn't add much because the baseline varies so much.
And the baseline itself is confounded by body composition. A lean person with a small waist is going to show a larger percentage change from the same absolute expansion.
Right. And visceral fat changes the compliance of the abdominal wall. A person with more abdominal fat might show less visible distension for the same internal pressure change because the fat acts as a buffer, or more depending on where the fat sits. It's not clean.
So Daniel should track absolute centimeters, not percentages.
Yes, and he should track the morning fasting number as his baseline, then the post-meal number at a fixed interval. The delta is what matters. If the delta is stable over a month, that's his personal normal. If it's increasing, that's a trend. If it's decreasing, something is changing.
And the photos are the visual anchor for the numbers.
The photos are what make the numbers meaningful. A 4 centimeter increase sounds small. But a photo showing a flat stomach in the morning and a visible paunch after a cheese sandwich, that's what makes a doctor sit up and say, okay, something is happening here.
Let's talk about what a neurogastroenterologist would actually do with this data. Daniel's hoping the pattern might give clues to the physiological mechanism.
The first thing they'd look at is whether the distension is consistent with abdominophrenic dysinergia. That means the distension worsens through the day, is worse after meals, and isn't necessarily associated with excess gas or bowel symptoms. If the photos show that pattern, the next step might be a pulmonary function test or an ultrasound to confirm the muscle coordination problem.
And if the pattern is different, if it's more about early satiety and nausea, that points toward gastroparesis.
Or if it's associated with belching and flatulence and responds to dietary changes, that points toward SIBO or carbohydrate malabsorption. The diary is what separates these. A single photo won't do it. A month of photos and measurements might.
So the data collection isn't just about documenting the problem. It's about triaging the possible causes.
And it's about giving the specialist something to work with that isn't a 10-minute conversation in an office where the patient is probably not bloated at that moment. The distension is often intermittent. If Daniel shows up to an appointment with a flat stomach, the doctor might not see what he's describing. The photos solve that.
Which is why the photography protocol matters so much. If the photos are inconsistent, the doctor can't tell whether the distension is real or just a camera angle artifact.
And that's the tragedy of most patient photos. They're taken in a mirror with the phone held at chest height, which foreshortens the abdomen and makes everything look flatter than it is. Or they're taken from above, which exaggerates the belly. Or the lighting is so bad that the contour is invisible.
So the protocol is, stand against a neutral wall, mark the floor, phone at navel height, front and side views, same time of day, same meal, same lighting.
And take the photos before and after the meal, not just after. The contrast is what makes the distension visible. A single bloated photo with no baseline is just a photo of a belly.
There's something almost poignant about the idea of a man documenting his own abdomen with the rigor of a clinical trial, just to get a doctor to take him seriously.
That's the reality of chronic functional GI disorders. The patients who get taken seriously are the ones who show up with data. The ones who don't are the ones who get told to eat more fiber and reduce stress.
And Daniel's been through this for years. He's not a stranger to being dismissed.
Which is why the data collection is also a form of self-advocacy. He's building the case that his body is doing something specific and reproducible, and that it deserves investigation.
Let's get back to the measurement science for a minute, because there's a gap here that I think is worth naming. The field doesn't have standardized self-measurement protocols. Daniel is essentially inventing his own.
And that's not a criticism of him, it's a gap in the field. The Rome Foundation guidelines emphasize patient-reported outcomes, but they don't tell patients how to measure their own distension. There's no validated home girth measurement protocol for functional GI disorders. The biofeedback trial used girth as an outcome, but that was in a clinical setting with trained staff.
So Daniel's tape measure protocol is a reasonable improvisation, but it's not validated.
It's what a thoughtful patient does when the field hasn't caught up. And if he standardizes his own protocol, the data will be useful for tracking his own trends, even if it can't be compared to a population.
And that's the honest answer to his question about benchmarks. There's no normal percentage. There's no validated threshold. There's just his own baseline, tracked over time.
Which is still more than most patients have. And it's more than most doctors will ask for.
So the tape measure is useful, the photos are useful, the diary is useful, and the benchmark he's hoping for doesn't exist yet.
That's the summary. But I want to add one thing about the photos. The side view is the one that matters most for abdominophrenic dysinergia, because that's where you see the abdominal wall contour relative to the chest. If the belly protrudes past the rib cage in profile, that's the pattern. If it's just a general puffiness, that's less specific.
So we should prioritize the side view, if he's only going to take one photo.
Front and side, both. But if he has to choose, side.
He should probably take the photos in the same clothing, or no clothing, because different waistbands compress the abdomen differently.
That's a detail most people don't think about. A tight waistband will compress the lower abdomen and make the distension look smaller. Loose clothing will hide the contour. The most consistent approach is bare abdomen, same lighting, same position.
The bathroom mirror selfie is actually not the worst approach, if he standardizes it.
The mirror is a problem because the phone is in the way and the angle is hard to control. Better to use the front-facing camera on a timer or a tripod, or prop the phone on a shelf at navel height.
I'm picturing Daniel setting up a tripod in his bathroom at 7 in the morning, marking the floor with tape, eating a cheese sandwich, and waiting 2 hours to take the after photo.
That's what it takes to get useful data. It's not glamorous, it's not convenient, but it's the difference between a doctor saying, interesting, and a doctor saying, I can see exactly what you mean.
Let's talk about the broader implications, because I think there's something here about how medicine handles symptoms that are visible to the patient, but invisible to the doctor.
That's the core of the functional GI problem. Bloating and distension are subjective experiences that don't show up on standard tests. A CT scan won't show abdominophrenic dyssynergia, and endoscopy won't show it. The patient knows something is wrong, but the tests say normal, and the doctor concludes it's stress or diet.
The patient is left holding a photo of their own distended abdomen, trying to prove that their body is doing something real.
Which is why the data collection matters beyond the individual case. If enough patients documented their distension with standardized protocols, the field could start building the normal ranges that don't currently exist. Daniel's tape measure and photo series is a tiny contribution to a data set that should exist but doesn't.
He's not just tracking his own symptoms. He's participating in the creation of a measurement standard.
In a small way, yes, and that's the frontier. Neurogastroenterology is starting to recognize that patient-generated data is valuable, but the protocols aren't there yet. The wearable tech angle is coming, continuous abdominal girth monitoring, but it's not ready for clinical use.
A belt that measures your waist circumference continuously.
There are prototypes, strain sensors woven into fabric. The idea is that you'd get a continuous record of abdominal distension throughout the day, which would capture the pattern in a way that spot measurements can't. But the validation work isn't done.
Daniel's tape measure is the current state of the art for a motivated patient.
It's the best available tool for someone who wants to track their own distension at home. The photos add the visual dimension. The symptom log adds the context. Together, it's a reasonable facsimile of what a clinical study would collect.
The whole thing rests on the patient's willingness to be rigorous about it.
Which is the other problem. Most patients won't do this. It's tedious. It's embarrassing. It requires a level of detachment about your own body that most people don't have. Daniel's willingness to photograph his own distended abdomen and measure it with a tape is unusual.
But it's also the only way to get the data that the field hasn't provided.
Right. And that's the paradox. The patient has to become the researcher because the researchers haven't asked the question yet.
Let's get concrete about what Daniel should actually do, because I think we've been circling the practical advice.
Here's the protocol. Morning fasting, after urinating, before eating or drinking. Stand in the same spot, feet shoulder width apart, arms relaxed, measure at the navel, tape snug but not compressing, at the end of a normal exhale. 3 measurements, average them. Take a front photo and a side photo, phone at navel height, same distance, same lighting, neutral background. Then eat the standardized meal. Wait a fixed interval. 2 hours is reasonable. Repeat the measurements and the photos.
Do this every day for at least 2 weeks, ideally a month.
Log the symptoms. Pain, fullness, nausea, belching, bowel movements. What he ate, when he ate it. The diary is what turns the numbers into a story.
Then he brings the whole thing to a neurogastroenterologist and says, "Here's my body, documented."
The specialist can look at the pattern and say, "This looks like abdominophrenic dyssynergia. Let's confirm with an ultrasound." Or, "This looks like a motility problem. Let's do a gastric emptying study."
That's the payoff. Not a diagnosis from the data itself, but a triage to the right test.
The data doesn't diagnose, it directs.
If the pattern is abdominophrenic dyssynergia, the treatment is biofeedback, which is actually effective.
The 2019 trial showed significant girth reduction after biofeedback. It's not a cure for everything, but for the muscular coordination problem, it works. And the tape measure is how you'd know.
The tape measure isn't just for documentation. It's for evaluating treatment.
That's the part most patients miss. They measure to prove they're sick, but the measurement is also how you prove you're getting better.
I want to sit with that for a second. Daniel's instinct was to collect data to understand his triggers. But the same data is what he'd use to evaluate whether a treatment works. It's not just a diagnostic tool. It's a longitudinal instrument.
That's why the protocol matters so much. If the measurements are inconsistent, he can't tell whether a change is real or just noise. The rigor is what makes the data usable for both purposes.
The answer to his question, is it as simple as running a tape measure around your belly button, is yes, but only if you're willing to be obsessive about the details.
The answer to the benchmark question is, there's no benchmark, but here's the range from healthy volunteers, and here's why it doesn't apply cleanly to you.
The answer to the photography question is, stand against a wall, mark the floor, phone at navel height, front and side, same time, same lighting, same meal.
The answer to the bigger question, is this worth doing, is yes, because it's the only way to get a doctor to see what you see.
There's a version of this conversation where we just tell Daniel to take some photos and not worry about the details, but that would be doing him a disservice.
The details are the whole thing. A blurry photo of a bloated belly isn't data. A series of standardized photos with matching tape measurements is a clinical document.
The fact that he's asking about lighting and angles suggests he already knows this. He's not just venting, he's trying to do it right.
Which is rare. Most patients don't think about camera angles. They just take a photo and hope it conveys what they feel.
Daniel's a technologist. He thinks in systems. Of course he's going to want a protocol.
The protocol we've described is basically what a clinical photographer would do for a research study. Fixed distance, fixed angle, fixed lighting, fixed position. It's not complicated, but it's specific.
I keep thinking about the cheese sandwich. The fact that he's using a standardized meal is already a step toward rigor. He just needs to formalize the rest.
The cheese sandwich is actually a decent test meal. Bread, cheese, water, carbohydrate, fat, fluid. It's reproducible. He could do worse.
It's a meal he actually eats, which means the data reflects his real life, not a lab protocol.
That's the trade-off. A lab meal is more standardized, but a real meal is more relevant to his actual triggers. If the cheese sandwich is a trigger, then tracking is exactly what he should be doing.
The protocol is, keep the cheese sandwich, add the tape measure, add the photos, add the log.
Do it for a month, then look at the pattern.
If the pattern shows that the distension is consistent and reproducible, he has something to show a specialist.
If the pattern shows that it varies wildly from day to day, that's also information. It means the triggers are more complex than a single meal.
Either way, he learns something.
That's the point of the whole exercise. Not to prove he's sick, but to understand the shape of the problem.
Let's talk about what might come after the data collection. If he gets to a neurogastroenterologist and the pattern suggests abdominophrenic dyssynergia, what does the diagnostic workup look like?
The gold standard is an ultrasound, or a pulmonary function test that shows the abdominal wall contracting when it should be relaxing during breathing. It's not invasive. It's just not commonly ordered because most gastroenterologists aren't thinking about the diaphragm.
If it's confirmed, the treatment is biofeedback.
Biofeedback with electromyography or ultrasound guidance. The patient learns to relax the abdominal wall during inhalation. It takes several sessions, but the 2019 study showed that the effect on girth was real.
The path from tape measure to treatment is actually pretty direct, if the pattern points that way.
It's direct if the specialist recognizes the pattern. And the data Daniel collects is what makes the pattern visible.
That's the hopeful version of this story. The less hopeful version is that the data shows something else, and the path is longer.
But even then, the data narrows the possibilities. If the distension doesn't match the abdominophrenic dyssynergia pattern, then the specialist can move on to motility testing or breath testing for SIBO. The diary is the triage tool.
The data isn't wasted even if the first hypothesis is wrong.
That's the whole point of collecting it systematically. It's not about confirming a hunch. It's about generating the evidence that points somewhere.
4 centimeters isn't nothing. I used to photograph bellies for a gastroenterology clinic, and 4 centimeters was the difference between a normal afternoon and a patient who looked like she'd swallowed a basketball.
Wait, what?
It was a research study on irritable bowel syndrome. They wanted standardized photos of abdominal distension before and after a meal challenge. I was the photographer. We marked the floor with tape so the patient stood in the same spot every time. There was a cheer for the side view. The patients called it the belly photo booth.
That's exactly the protocol we've been describing.
It worked, mostly. The problem was the girth-o-meter. That's what the research assistant called it. A spring-loaded tape measure that was supposed to give a consistent tension reading. It was garbage. The spring would stick, or the patient would inhale at the wrong moment, or the tape would slip. We got numbers, but I never trusted them.
A spring-loaded tape measure for abdominal girth. That's a device that sounds like it was designed by someone who'd never measured a human body.
It was designed by an engineer who thought the problem was the tape. The problem was the human. People breathe. They shift. They suck in their gut when they see the tape coming. The device didn't fix any of that.
The study never got clean data.
The sample size was too small anyway. 14 patients. The clinic never published. But the photos were good. I still remember the woman who came in with a flat stomach and left looking 6 months pregnant. Same day, same camera, same spot on the floor.
That's the thing Daniel's trying to capture.
He should skip the fancy tape measure. A plain tailor's tape, the kind you get for $2, is more reliable than anything with a spring. Just pull it snug and read the number. The consistency comes from the person, not the device.
That's actually the key point. The protocol matters more than the instrument.
The photos matter more than the numbers. A photo doesn't lie about the contour. A tape measure can be off by a centimeter depending on how you breathe. The photo shows the shape.
The photo is the primary data, and the tape measure is the secondary check.
That's how I'd do it. Photo first, then measure, and mark the floor. That part isn't optional.
Did you ever have a patient who brought in their own photos?
Once. She'd been photographing her belly every morning for 6 months. Same spot in her bathroom, same time, same camera. The gastroenterologist took one look at the series and said, "That's abdominophrenic dyssynergia. Let's get an ultrasound." She was right. The patient had diagnosed herself with a camera.
That's both inspiring and a little depressing.
It's the job. The doctor should have caught it years earlier, but the photos made it impossible to miss.
That's the power of a standardized series.
The thing I wonder about is whether Daniel's measurements would let him spot the pattern before a doctor does. If he takes the photos and the tape numbers for a month, and the distension always peaks 2 hours after eating and resolves by morning, that's a pattern. He could walk into the appointment and say, "Here's what my body does every day for a month." That's not a complaint. That's a data set.
The data set is what gets him past the first 10 minutes of the appointment.
The first 10 minutes are where most patients lose. The doctor's looking at the chart, not the patient. If you can hand over a folder of photos and measurements, the doctor has to look.
That's the practical value of what Daniel's doing.
The one thing I'd add is, don't let the photos sit on a phone. Print them. Or put them in a document with the dates and the measurements. A phone gallery is too easy to scroll past. A printed page with a series of photos and numbers, that's a document.
The deliverable is a physical folder.
Or a PDF, something the doctor can flip through. The format matters. A series of photos in a grid, morning on the left, post-meal on the right, dates underneath. That's what makes the pattern visible.
That's a useful tip.
I did this for a living. Well, for one study. The rest of the time I was doing passport photos and the occasional wedding. The belly study was the most interesting job I ever had.
Of course it was.
The clinic paid me in cash and let me keep the tape marks on the floor. I still had the girth-o-meter somewhere. It's in a box with the other junk from that decade.
The spring-loaded one?
It never worked right, but I kept it. Sentimental value.
The takeaway is simple tools, rigorous protocol, and print the photos.
Don't trust a spring-loaded tape measure.
That's a good note to end the practical part on.
There's a bigger question underneath all of this, which is whether the field will ever catch up to what patients like Daniel are doing on their own.
The wearable angle is the most likely path. If continuous abdominal girth monitoring becomes validated, then the normal ranges that don't currently exist could be built from real-world data, but that's years off.
In the meantime, the patients who want answers have to become their own measurement lab.
Which is what Daniel's doing. And the fact that he's asking about camera angles and percentage benchmarks means he's taking it seriously.
The one thing I'd want to leave with is...
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.